What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by ASP Adjunct Fellow and State Department Public Affairs Officer Xander Vag. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem.
So, Xander, we want to talk to you about public diplomacy.
Yeah, no, it's I'm glad to be here to talk about it.
So you do a lot of work with the U.S. Diplomacy Center, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So as you said, I am a foreign affairs officer and PMF at the State Department in the Public Affairs Bureau. And the U.S. Diplomacy Center is essentially a museum and education center that the department wanted to create basically to kind of spread awareness of what it is the department does. So it was initially sort of tossed about as an idea even as far back as World War II in the post-war environment, and then sort of came to fruition in about 2000 under Madeleine Albright, and now is getting ready to be slated to open in 2018. So yeah, basically it's just a way for the department to educate the American public on what it is the State Department and Foreign Service officers do.
So you say this is an initiative started by Secretary Albright and is slated to open in 2018. So this is a physical space.
Yeah, yeah, it's a physical space in the department's, you know, Harry S. Truman Building, and it's going to be built actually into the building itself. So it's going to have multiple levels. It's going to have, you know, an education center, various artifacts from America's diplomatic history, some really cool stuff that hopefully should help people kind of understand why they should give, you know, any kind of care about the department.
Sure. One of the issues that we do a lot of work on here at ASP is helping people understand that diplomacy is not separate from security. Diplomacy is, in fact, part of security. It is an important component of our national security strategy. I'm wondering your thoughts on that and how you feel your work at State or simply your own experience, how you see what you do fits into national security.
Sure. So I guess I would come at it from the angle of, you know, having worked in a few different places in D.C. In my last job, I was doing a lot of stuff with the Pentagon and the Department of Defense, and now I'm at State. So I don't think you can ever necessarily untie the if you want to call it hard security angles of what our government does with the quote-unquote softer tools of the State Department. So any of the exercises that I would be involved with in my last job with the Department of Defense, it was really, you know, you'd have State Department there, you'd have someone from DHS, from the National Security Council, from whatever branches there were. So I don't think any government agency is able to really direct our foreign affairs policy by itself unilaterally. So with State, I think that a lot of times it's a different part of national security in that you don't see the same necessarily direct effects in terms of what people consider national security, but a lot of times if you're trying to arrange a treaty or improve cultural understandings, there's always going to be specific repercussions for the, you know, quote-unquote national security apparatus and, you know, our sort of status in the world as a national security power.
Sure. So can you talk a little bit more about that? And when you say, you know, treaties, relationships in general, what is the role of diplomacy when you're looking at something like COP21 or TPP or maybe you're even looking at a status of forces agreement? What is the role of diplomacy there?
Yeah, so I mean, so any relationship that you have, you know, take any of the relationships we have in Asia, TPP is definitely going to affect those relationships. And, you know, the extent to which it has an interaction with military forces or our ability to, you know, exert hard power overseas, I think there's definitely going to be an effect because, you know, the relationships between countries are, they're never just going to be military to military. They're never going to be purely economic or purely political. They're always going to have different facets. So, you know, if now someone is a TPP member and previously they weren't, that's going to change our relationship with them. You know, ideally there's always the idea thrown around that democracies don't fight each other. I think that's an indication of the way that diplomacy and, you know, for example, economic treaties and economic relationships can really help to affect the entire relationship of two countries, regardless of, you know, the sort of military elements.
So when you think about how the U.S. government, how the U.S. public, both separately and together, understand diplomacy, what do you think we're doing right and where do you think we need to put a little more effort?
In terms of our own diplomatic sort of efforts?
Yeah, I would, you know, our diplomatic efforts and how we even just understand the concept of diplomacy. You know, what do people not know that they really should?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot. So the Diplomacy Center is one avenue of trying to make that argument for why people should care about what it is the diplomats do, because so often it's completely misunderstood or not understood at all. You know, it's a lot of times it just can be a matter of optics, in terms of you look at somewhere like the Department of Defense and you see, you know, an image of a soldier protecting, you know, what a base or their fellow soldiers and all that stuff. It's a very easy thing to visualize and understand at a fairly fundamental level. I would say for, you know, diplomacy is not as easily understood because there's a lot of different ways that it comes about, right? So our pop culture in the States is very effective at getting people to be familiar with American culture, mm-hmm. and, you know, really extend to like a lot of the positive things about the United States. Diplomacy could also be outside of entertainment. It can be economics. It can be people-to-people relationships, social interactions. So I think it's a much kind of larger field that isn't necessarily as inherently graspable as the Department of Defense or, you know, a military kind of angle. So I don't think that people necessarily understand the extent to which diplomacy happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you really wanted to better understand it, you would have to take a step back and not necessarily only consider like government diplomacy efforts. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that the Department of State's trying to do is involve, you know, some of those elements, you know, trying to work with Hollywood so that their, you know, coverage of the Department of State or how government works could be more accurate. Mm-hmm. And hopefully people would
be
interested
in that. Do you mean to say the West Wing may have not been accurate?
Yeah, it's apparently it's possible.
That is just earth-shattering.
Right. But on the other hand, that show did bring a lot of interest into Washington specifically.
Absolutely. You have a whole generation of people who now have moved here because mm-hmm. they saw, well, hey, I could do that.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's no question that, you know, popular culture things definitely have an effect. But as far as your question on what we could be doing better, you mean the State Department specifically?
I don't think just the State Department specifically. I think, you know, maybe if that's where your gut is telling you to go. But mm-hmm. I think diplomacy, like you've said, is bigger than just the State Department. It's our media, it's our culture, it's programs like Fulbright. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, as Matthew Wallen, our ASP's senior fellow for public diplomacy, does a lot of talk about, you know, people-to-people engagement and cultural diplomacy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some really interesting work on bringing artists, musicians from the U.S. to remote parts of India.
Mm-hmm.
That's an incredible initiative.
Yeah.
But not everything we do is that incredible.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, you know, and it's probably one of the reasons why other parts of government maybe get a little more press is because the work of a diplomat or someone working at the Department of State, a lot of times I remember reading how if you're in sort of the more academic community, a lot of times what it is that you're trying to do is really distinguish yourself as an individual
mm-hmm.
and really focus on what you personally can contribute, whereas
right.
if you're in somewhere like State, you know, it's much more about a team effort and
a collective action.
Yeah, and what kind of wins you can get when you can get them. You know,
right.
and a lot of
the
times
shared identity.
Yeah,
it's
gonna be
different.
Usually completely anonymous, you know, the team right. responsible for something like that.
Absolutely.
So as far as, you know, what diplomacy can do better, I think maybe if people could have a little bit better of an understanding of the inherent sort of anonymity of some of these efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, because it's tough, right? It's not easy to understand why a foreign affairs officer who's working in the economic section of an embassy in Japan trying to affect free trade, whatever your positions on that are, trying to improve our relationships with them, and maybe even nail down a very specific aspect of a treaty in very specific language. You know, the ordinary, you know, everyday person who doesn't necessarily interact and swim in that world wouldn't really get why that's important.
Mm-hmm.
But they still see the effects of it, you know, fairly easily in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, what they pay for one of their electronic devices.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, being able to buy, you know, some kind of import that they wouldn't be able to otherwise. So, yeah, it's kind of a tough argument to be made, but I think that if people could be a little bit more understanding of the complexity of it, it would be a good thing.
So obviously, diplomacy, you know, you look at the prefix, this is not a one-way street. The United mm-hmm. States is not the only country or entity to do, if you can, do diplomacy, right? Mm-hmm. We're on the receiving end of diplomacy. It's multilateral or at least bilateral engagement. So it would be great if you could talk a little bit about diplomacy from other countries and whether that is their governments or NGOs, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways that nations interact with each other. And, you know, it's, I mean, one thing I definitely am aware of is I kind of have this fantasy of, like, you know, I should have worked in government in, like, you know, the 70s or something when things were seemingly far less complicated in terms of, you know, how you interacted with someone. And it was, you know, it was very much
not so
just
much social media and Twitter and all these things to be worried about.
Right. You would write cables and then you would get that information from those cables and
it would be done.
Yeah. And then you could just very much have a government to government and in a lot of cases, very private relationships. And obviously, you know, transparency is great, but it does complicate things quite a bit. So,
democracy,
for example,
is messy.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I'm probably still a fan of the system overall.
Who's not at this point?
I would say. Yeah. but yeah, so for example, one thing I'm working on now is getting ready to work on World Refugee Day, which involves a lot of different countries and has a lot of different moving parts. So one thing we're trying to do is basically make the ordinary American more aware of refugee issues and how it might affect them, as well as, you know, some of the challenges that refugees are having to deal with. And there's obviously, you know, fighting misinformation is a big deal of that,
especially when it comes to refugees.
Yeah. It's you know, it's a complex issue and not necessarily well understood by people who don't
want
live
to
in
understand.
DC. Or yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I think maybe one of the biggest struggles for diplomacy is making people understand who simply don't want to, have no interest in getting into the complexities. And how do you communicate with them? And if you can't get them on your side, how do you at least make them less hostile?
Yeah. I mean, so one way we do that is the office I am in actually runs something called diplomatic simulations, which are basically kind of a 1 to 2 hour role-playing exercise where you will represent various actors and people in government and outside of government and NGOs and, you know, people in the UN, multilateral organizations, and you kind of run through, okay, you have this refugee crisis and there's serious conditions of people dying and people facing all kinds of terrible circumstances. What are you going to do? And how do you come to a negotiated agreement? So I think that, you know, if you wanted to talk about ways that diplomacy isn't necessarily understood, I think sort of the key skills of negotiating are not necessarily as appreciated as, you know, people just think that countries talk to each other and it's a very scientific, you know, exact process. And people don't really understand that there's a very human element of how negotiations happen and how to really understand another person's perspective and all these things that, you know, because nations are so large that it's just sort of thrown into this big, you know, oh, people must have a process for doing it and there must be very specific steps. And there are, but the human element definitely comes into effect.
It always comes into play.
Yeah. So with the multilateral, that's, you know, that's always going to be there. I was just volunteering for the nuclear security summit President Obama had, and you know, it was fascinating. I was basically operating an information booth.
Right.
And I was there. The Department of State took the lead. But, you know, I had people from, you know, Azerbaijan and, you know, Japan, Korea.
All those motorcades that tied up all that traffic.
Yes. Yeah.
Good to know that there were real people here.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. I saw people run around. And it was crazy, but it was a really interesting sort of aspect of multilateral diplomacy, because you had all the official meetings, but then things happening outside of that.
Right. So you're saying the nuclear security summit, which has the word security in it, but also has the word summit, right? Bringing people together. That's an example of diplomacy. And, you know, how people think about nuclear security, you know, maybe it doesn't involve as they don't realize how much diplomacy it truly involves. And as those of us who are living, working in and around D.C. can attest, those motorcades were everywhere. So there were, in fact, people here. And they're coming together, and right there, it's at the meetings, and it's outside of the meetings. It's at the hotel bar. It's on the street. It's whatever.
Yeah, you get people protesting.
Absolutely.
You know, elements that are certainly not on the merits only of their nuclear policy alone. So, you know, nuclear is a perfect example of an issue that has, you know, what we would consider traditional security elements. But then also, you know, the softer side is, you know, is just energy itself and trying to find a new sort of optimal fuel for humanity.
A way forward, absolutely.
So, yeah, so it's not like you can ever separate the two, I would say.
So We touched briefly earlier on the U.S. Diplomacy Center, and I'd like to go back to that and to the best of your ability, you know, to kind of explain what the goals of that are. I mean, is it to reach out to, you know, some 20-something who lives in Salt Lake City and help them understand, you know, our relationship with Mali? Or is it for somebody like us who lives in D.C. and plays in this space and has a more specialized knowledge to walk in and be like, well, look at this, you know, incredible flask that Winston Churchill left in someone's bathroom. You know, like, or is it somewhere between there?
I would say probably somewhere between there, because you have, you know, we're trying, basically our formal task as the mission runs is to reach people, reach the American public, right? And then visitors from overseas, and but it's basically the general public is our audience, and that literally includes everyone. Because, you know, I think a lot of people in the Department of State have seen, basically, and this is where a sort of public affairs angle comes in, is they've seen other places make the argument, why should you care about me?
Absolutely.
And the Department of State has struggled a little bit with answering that argument.
It's a very difficult argument to make and answer to articulate.
Yeah. A lot of my friends who are, you know, they're in all kinds of fields, but a lot of them very intelligent people, guys who've gone to med school, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I just got a job with the Department of State. And I'll say, oh, that's really cool. Which state? And
that's comforting.
Yeah. These are intelligent, you know, very well-rounded people. But there
is a different space to be plugged into.
Yeah. And I think everyone has their sort of stereotypical ideas of, like, you know, what it is people in each major industry do. You know, like, oh, people in Wall Street, they're, you know, just do stuff with money. Or, you know, people in Hollywood and entertainment, you know, they make movies. But in D.C., it is a very insular place by definition. So there is a difficulty with understanding the place as a whole. And then where exactly the Department of State falls in to that is tough. So I think what we're trying to do is put a very, like, literally a physical thing in front of you that can make the argument, you know, okay, here's, you know, the first passport that was ever recorded from, you know, I think it was 1782 or something. And, you know, the first time a treaty was ever signed, or things that are sort of taken for granted today in terms of, oh, yeah, I want to go overseas, I'll get a passport.
Sure.
Well, why do you have to have a passport? What was the first time a passport was ever used? And, you know, things like collections from even just, I think it was a couple of months ago, the U.S. played the Cuban national team in an exhibition down there. So we're going to have, you know, some of the bats and gloves and some of
that's
the things
great.
From that event.
And that's diplomacy, right? That's that's cultural diplomacy. That's America's pastime, which, as is well documented and discussed, has some very interesting and strong ties throughout the Caribbean, but especially to Cuba. And I wonder your thoughts on our relationship, our budding relationship with Cuba, and thinking specifically not so much about the political and the economic, but that's certainly an aspect, but from a diplomatic perspective to watch this unfold, what do you think that says about how we think about security in the 21st century?
Well, I think it's so, I mean, the first time I sort of became aware of Cuba was, you know, reading about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is, you know, a very, you know, if you want to talk about an event that, you know,
talk about hard security. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, so that's right there. So, I mean, personally, I'm optimistic. You know, I'm a big fan of Ropa Vieja. So I'm excited about maybe one day going into Cuba and Havana and ordering some of that rather than Florida where I grew up. But yeah, I think most people are pretty optimistic about it, at least the folks that I work with, because a lot of them actually there's a few people who worked in Havana before there were
Alan Gross's press conference was right in this room where we're sitting right now.
So I think that people are fairly excited about it, and you know, I think the amount of work that it took to make that a reality is a good example of diplomacy being very effective.
And to your point about anonymity, very few people know who was involved there. Maybe that's not the case in D.C., but you know, this is diplomacy is not really for people in Washington, D.C. It's for people in Salt Lake City. It's for people in Ithaca, New York. It's for people in, you know, remote parts of Mongolia.
Yeah.
And it's for people in Mali. And it's how not just we talk to ourselves, but how we talk to other people.
Yeah. And I think that another sort of area, one of the things that was I was asked to think about was parts of diplomacy that aren't necessarily as easily understood.
Right.
So in terms of like your messaging, I think that's a huge area that people just don't think about because they're so, it's already a part of their everyday lives. So like everything that you read about, any kind of policy or bilateral relationship or relationship with another country is framed by how you are saying it.
Hmm.
And so in terms of, framing a conversation, it's critically important, especially as you see how modern technology has changed and affected how people think about these things. Because like we were saying, it used to be just, diplomatic cables were what people would use. And that was only government to government. So now, I don't think people understand that how you shape a narrative really in some ways ultimately defines it. And it might seem strange and almost Orwellian to think of it that way, but
chicken and the egg, right?
Yeah, a lot of times, in pure politicians, they've kind of understood that for a while, but
right.
Now because diplomacy and international affairs has become democratized in a lot of ways, the way the conversation goes, like I said, it kind of defines where it's going to go, how
sure.
people interpret things.
So I wonder if you can give us an example, or theoretical or not, of what you think it looks like when diplomacy goes right and what you think it looks like when it goes wrong.
So I think in terms of, my own personal views, I think that diplomacy, if we're talking about, so I'll talk about it in a non-government sense. I would say that diplomacy would go well when it embetters the lives of all the parties who are engaged in it and, really kind of minimizes any kind of conflict, whatever it is. So it can be as simple as, in Germany, they're obsessed with How I Met Your Mother, or, Conan O'Brien went to Korea and everyone loved him. And, they got a sense of American culture and entertainment and some things that are kind of unique to us as a country. As far as, an example of successful governmental diplomacy, things like Cuba, I think, are really great examples of positive diplomacy. I think a lot of the Iran deal that went out, there was, and that's shaped a lot by perception. But I think that ultimately there are some good things there, and it was a diplomatic effort that had some really great effects. And as far as diplomacy that hasn't worked out as well, I mean, there's plenty of examples of our history of things that
could have gone better.
Could have gone better, yeah. I'm trying to think of a specific...
Well, and maybe perhaps there isn't a specific example that comes to mind, but what does it look like in the sense of how do you know you've missed the mark in diplomacy? Mm. What are the telltale signs, or is it something as extreme as rioting in the streets, or are we talking just a subtly bad taste in someone's mouth? Are there tiffs over a state dinner and who serves what? Is that a failure of diplomacy, or is that simply not knowing someone's personal preferences?
I mean, there's definitely cases as small as that where, things that you should be thinking about in terms of another person's culture or whatever,
yeah.
those don't necessarily come on. But I think a big problem that people always harp about but don't necessarily focus as much on is interagency cooperation.
Sure.
A lot of times, there just isn't that conversation between different members of the government, and there's just so many disparate parts of people you should be coordinating with, but just don't focus as much
there's
on.
No, there's limited time, limited resources.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and I mean, you get so caught up in your own work that a lot of times you just feel completely siloed and you don't interact. So, like, say if there's some big initiative that's happening in some country in Southeast Asia, a lot of times you will only think about it in terms of not only the State Department's interaction with that and with the embassy, but only the public diplomacy sort of messaging angle of it, and not necessarily other repercussions that would happen, whether it's the Department of Defense or, Treasury or other parts, or, even local population,
Absolutely. There are, in fact, people that live in other countries.
Yeah.
They're not just governments.
Yeah. We get so caught up in our own sort of grand strategy stuff that we don't necessarily take the time to understand the other person's perspective.
Sure.
Or how something could be misinterpreted due to a lack of knowledge about a local custom or
Absolutely.
Just things that we haven't thought of.
And there's, certainly security concerns in that, right? When you forget that you're not just dealing with a government. You are, in fact, dealing with a people,
mm-hmm.
and many different kinds of people with many different ideals and values and likes and dislikes and priorities. It's easy to fumble. So
yeah,
my last question, Xander, is when you look down the road 15-ish years, if we fumble when it comes to diplomacy, what does that mean for our security? And if we get it right, what does that mean for our security too?
So, I mean, there's obviously plenty of opportunity to fumble. That's for sure.
Yeah, but that means there's equal opportunity to succeed, right?
Yeah, yeah, ideally. So I guess if you know, 15 years from now, there's a lot of different ways you could fumble. If you don't manage, you know, I think people can understand on a fundamental level, if you don't manage your relationships well, there's going to be repercussions, and it's not always something that you will necessarily know where those results came from. You know, if you don't manage your relationships with your allies, you know, God knows how that'll, you know, come back and bite you in the butt at some point. So I think that if you don't manage those relationships and you don't engage in effective diplomacy, it could be as far-reaching as some kind of physical conflict, or it could be something where, you know, some negotiation you have to do down the road becomes a lot harder than otherwise.
Mm.
And I think as far as opportunities to succeed, you know, I'd love to see some of the stuff with Cuba continue to improve, and relationships between our country and that country really
come together.
Yeah, and be everything it can. So I would love to see, you know, anything that looks like a more harmonious world, I think would be a good effort. And that's pretty much, you know,
isn't that the goal of security anyways?
Yeah,
a more
harmonious
world.
Yeah, it sounds a little self-aggrandizing, but there's ways to kind of make the world a better place. And I think that's what you're trying to achieve. But
sure,
any kind of incremental victory you can get, I'd love to see, you know, something like that in 15 years, or the equivalent of a Cuba opening up. So
absolutely. Well, Xander Vague, thanks so much for joining us. This is American Security Project's What's Next.